Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, May 24th, 2016, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call, Racial Pretext and Peremptory Jury Strikes, the Impact of Foster v. Chapman. My name is Tim Courtney. I'm the Assistant Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and note that today's call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our expert, Professor Joseph Hoffman. He is the Harry Prater Professor of Law at the Indiana University Maurer School of Law. Thanks for your time today, Professor Hoffman. With that, the floor is yours.
Okay, you're very welcome. I've been invited today to say a few words about yesterday's U.S. Supreme Court decision in Foster v. Chapman. This is a Batson case with a number of interesting procedural twists. So just to briefly review, I'm sure we're all familiar with the case of Batson against Kentucky decided by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1986. The Batson case established the principle that that peremptory challenges based on race are a violation of the Equal Protection Clause and that a prima facie case of unconstitutional race discrimination in the use of peremptories can be based on evidence from a single case, namely the defendant's own case. Batson overruled an earlier decision, or at least part of an earlier decision, Swain against Alabama. The Swain case in 1965 had established what was at that time the required evidentiary burden to establish a prima facie case of unconstitutional race discrimination in the use of peremptory challenges. Swain actually built on the foundation of a much earlier case, Strouder against West Virginia. Strouder in 1880 held that equal protection is violated whenever a black defendant in a criminal case is tried before a jury from which blacks have been purposefully excluded. Swain, nearly 100 years later, 85 years later, held that Strouder was not violated by the case-specific use of peremptories based on race, but only by such use if the prosecutor did so in case after case, whatever the circumstances, whatever the crime, and whomever the defendant or victim may be. In other words, Swain held that peremptories used to exclude black prospective jurors in all criminal cases in the jurisdiction was a violation of equal protection, but the use of peremptories in a single case based on the prosecutor's belief that the case had racial overtones or some other racial implications would not be a violation or would not establish the prima facie case. Batson then, in turn, overruled that aspect of Swain and held that, in fact, all a defendant needs to do to make out a prima facie case is to show that peremptories were used in their own case in a manner that raised an inference of intentional discrimination. And Batson made very clear that the prosecutor could not defend against such a claim by saying that the peremptories were used only because of the facts of the particular case. Batson said that even the use of peremptories in a single case based on the facts or the racial overtones of the case would still be a violation of equal protection. Under Batson's framework, it's a three-part test. It's the classic three-part test that we see in a number of equal protection situations. The classic three-part test, number one, the defendant, to make out the prima facie case, has to demonstrate that the use of peremptories in their case raises an inference that the peremptories were exercised on the basis of intentional race discrimination. At that point, the burden shifts to the prosecution to offer race-neutral reasons for those challenged peremptory strikes. And then finally, the burden shifts back to the defense to demonstrate or to persuade the court that the offered race-neutral reasons are in fact pretextual, and that in fact the peremptories were exercised on the basis of race. So it's a classic sort of bouncing burden of proof under Batson. Justice Marshall concurred in the decision in Batson. He said, and I quote, "The decision will not end the racial discrimination that peremptories inject into the jury selection process. That goal can be accomplished only by eliminating peremptory challenges entirely." Close quote. So the reason that Justice Marshall concurred is because he said, this is a good step, but it's not going to solve the problem because it's simply too easy for prosecutors to offer race-neutral reasons for what are, in fact, racially motivated strikes. And in language that actually presaged the Foster v. Chapman case, Justice Marshall gave an example. He said, any prosecutor can easily assert facially neutral reasons for striking a juror, and trial courts are ill-equipped to second-guess those reasons. How is the court to treat a prosecutor's statement that he struck a juror because the juror had a son about the same age as the defendant, or seemed uncommunicative, or never cracked a smile? These are the examples that Justice Marshall gave in his Batson concurrence. The dissent in Batson was written by Justice Rehnquist, and his dissent was based largely on the argument that there's nothing unequal if the prosecutor uses peremptories to strike black jurors in a case involving a black defendant, so long as the prosecutor also uses similar peremptories to exclude white jurors in cases involving white defendants, Hispanic jurors in cases involving Hispanic defendants, Asian American jurors in cases involving Asian defendants, and so on. This was a reflection of Justice Rehnquist's belief that the Equal Protection Clause is only violated by differential treatment and not by simply race-based treatment. So that's the Batson case, and that's the foundation for the case the court decided yesterday. In short order, after the Batson decision, the Supreme Court extended Batson to other types of situations and other types of circumstances. In Holland and Powers, the cases decided in 1990 and 1991, the Supreme Court held that even white defendants can raise as an equal protection claim the exclusion of black prospective jurors. In effect, the white defendant stands as a third party to raise the rights of those jurors to serve. In McCollum in 1992, the Supreme Court extended Batson to the defendant's use of peremptories. So after McCollum, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, and both parties in a criminal case must avoid race-based use of peremptories. And in JEB in 1994, the court extended Batson to gender-based peremptories. Interestingly, JEB did something that Batson didn't do. The JEB case, in the JEB case, the court actually discussed openly the question of whether jurors of different gender, specifically in that case men and women, would be or could be expected to look at cases differently or to decide certain kinds of issues in cases differently. There was no discussion of that in Batson. The court in Batson seemingly proceeded on the assumption that there really was no difference between white jurors and black jurors, and that we're all generic. But in the JEB case, Justice O'Connor and Justice Blackmun specifically said that it doesn't matter that women sometimes see certain issues in certain cases differently from men. It's still not a valid reason for a prosecutor to exercise peremptories based on gender. In a series of cases, another series of cases, the Supreme Court has looked at Batson claims on the facts to decide whether or not the defendant had met their initial burden, whether the prosecutor had met the secondary burden of showing race-neutral reasons, and then ultimately whether the defendant had carried the ultimate burden of showing that those race-neutral reasons are pretextual or were pretextual. In the first couple of cases after Batson was decided, Hernandez, Perkett versus Elam, these were in the 1990s, the Supreme Court upheld the prosecutor's proffered race-neutral reasons. But in a series of cases starting in the mid-2000s, the Supreme Court seemed to want to toughen up the review standard a little bit. And this is kind of typical of Batson cases in the Supreme Court. Batson cases in the Supreme Court, I would say, are similar to two other kinds of cases, ineffective assistance cases and Brady cases involving alleged prosecutorial misconduct in non-disclosure of exculpatory evidence. These three categories of cases, ineffective assistance, Brady cases, and Batson cases, the basic legal standard for all three of these kinds of claims hasn't changed or has only changed in a very minor way since the court first established that standard in each instance, more than 30 years ago. The law hasn't changed, but the Supreme Court still, on occasion, every couple of years, takes a case under each of these three types of claims to basically send a signal to lower courts that they either need to ratchet up the scrutiny that they give to these claims or that they're being too aggressive and should chill. And that's kind of how I would characterize what the Supreme Court has been largely doing in all three areas over the past, say, 10 to 15 years. So in the Batson context in the 1990s, the court seemingly wanted to send a signal to lower courts that, not every case is going to be a Batson violation. It's okay. Prosecutors sometimes might do something that looks like race discrimination in peremptory challenges, but it's not always so. And that was the sort of impact of Hernandez and Purkett versus Elam. More recently, the court has been sending a signal the other direction, telling lower courts that, you really do need to police this stuff and, don't slack off in your review of Batson claims. And that is most notable in a two-part decision by the Supreme Court in the Miller L case. Miller L was a case out of Texas, out of the Fifth Circuit, that went to the Supreme Court twice. The first time it went to the Supreme Court in 2003 because the Fifth Circuit had denied what's called a certificate of appealability on a Batson claim that had been raised in federal habeas. The Supreme Court reviewed the Fifth Circuit's denial of the certificate of appealability, and in very forceful terms, the court held that the Fifth Circuit had wrongly denied that certificate, that there was plenty of evidence in the record to raise an inference of race discrimination in the prosecutor's use of peremptories, and that therefore the Fifth Circuit should have allowed the case to come up on appeal to that court. The Fifth Circuit then got the case on remand, and perhaps inexplicably, in light of the Supreme Court's tone, the court said, okay, we'll hear the appeal, and then denied the Batson claim on the merits. The Supreme Court in 2005, in again quite abrupt terms, struck down the Fifth Circuit's second decision, basically saying, didn't you get the message? We told you there was merit to this claim when we reversed you in 2003. How could you now deny the claim on the merits in 2005? So that's the Miller L litigation. And again, didn't change any law, just sent a signal to the Fifth Circuit and to all other lower courts that Batson claims are claims that the court wants taken very seriously. That brings us to the current case, Foster v. Chapman. This case originated in August of 1986. So again, we're talking about a 30-year-old case. In August of 1986, Timothy Foster was arrested and charged with a brutal murder, sexual assault, and robbery. This was charged as a capital offense. He was facing the death penalty. Foster was poor, intellectually disabled, black teenager. The victim was a 79-year-old white widow, so a very racially charged case. This occurred in Rome, Georgia. The defendant confessed to the crime. So the issue really was mostly about whether Foster would receive the death sentence. There wasn't too much dispute about whether he had committed the crime. The jury was all white. There had been five black prospective jurors in the group of 42 that survived the challenges for cause and were then subjected to peremptory challenges. There were five blacks out of 42. One of the blacks was struck on a late challenge for cause. Something came out during the voir dire that caused the judge to strike that juror for cause, and both sides agreed that that juror was properly struck for cause. That left four blacks in the group of prospective jurors, and all four of those were struck by the prosecutor on peremptory challenge. The defendant was convicted by the all-white jury and was sentenced to death. The defendant made a motion for a new trial based in part on an alleged Batson violation. Keep in mind, it may be significant to note that Batson had been decided just a few months before the defendant's trial, so it was really new at that time. The defendant made a new trial motion based on an alleged Batson violation. That motion was denied. The defendant's sentence and conviction and sentence were affirmed on appeal, with the Georgia Supreme Court specifically rejecting the defendant's Batson claim in its 1988 decision on the direct appeal. Many years later, the defendant was in litigation in state habeas corpus and once again raised the Batson claim in the state habeas petition. In connection with the state habeas petition, the defense requested the prosecution files that related to jury selection in the case. This request was made under Georgia's open records law, and in fact, those files were turned over to the defense. The defense found some remarkable information in those files. The defense found, for example, that on all of the jury questionnaires, the prospective jurors' race had been circled, that there were lists of prospective jurors prepared by the prosecutor's office in which green highlighting had been used to highlight all black prospective jurors. The prosecution had prepared a definite no list, in other words, jurors who would definitely not be allowed to serve and would be struck by peremptory. All of the black prospective jurors, all five of the ones who were initially in that group, were on the definite no list. One of the prospective jurors was a member of a church, and the prosecution paperwork had written on that particular juror's form, "no black church," underlined. There was also an affidavit from one of the prosecution's investigators in which the investigator, reporting to his prosecutorial superiors, wrote the following words: "If it comes down to having to pick one of the black jurors," he went on to say which one he thought should be picked if they had to. This information came to light, as I said, during the open records request made during the state habeas litigation. Defendant's lawyers then sought to introduce that information in the state habeas case, and the state habeas judge, over some objections, allowed these papers to be introduced as evidence. Nevertheless, the state habeas court denied the petition in 2013. That denial was based in part on the fact that the state habeas court found the claim to be barred by res judicata. That bar depended at least based on the words of the habeas judge, on the judge's view that there wasn't any merit in the underlying claim. Here's exactly what the habeas court said. The court said, "The state argues that this claim is not reviewable due to the doctrine of res judicata. However, because Foster claims that additional evidence allegedly supporting this ground was discovered subsequent to the Georgia Supreme Court's ruling on direct appeal, this court will review the Batson claim as to whether Foster has shown any change in the facts sufficient to overcome the res judicata bar," close quote. So again, the state habeas court decides in 2013 that after reviewing the new evidence, after reviewing the material from the prosecutor's files, that those materials do not demonstrate enough of a change in the facts, enough of a change to show that there was merit in the Batson claim, and therefore the res judicata bar applies. And the court concluded specifically that, quote, the renewed Batson claim is without merit, close quote. So this created a bit of a problem for the U.S. Supreme Court, but let me just hold that thought for a moment. The habeas denial by the state habeas trial court went up to the state Supreme Court. The state Supreme Court denied a certificate of probable cause to appeal. In a single sentence, the court just said, we're not going to take the case. Didn't say anything about the reason why. At that point, the order itself read as follows, quote, upon consideration of the application for certificate of probable cause to appeal the denial of habeas corpus, it is ordered that it be hereby denied. All the justices concur except Benham J., who dissents, close quote. So you have a state habeas court, trial court, denying the habeas petition on the grounds that there's not enough merit in the petition, in the new evidence, to justify overcoming the bar of res judicata based on the previous decisions in the direct appeal. And then you have the state Supreme Court in a one-sentence order denying a certificate of probable cause to appeal. Now the case comes to the U.S. Supreme Court on a cert petition. The U.S. Supreme Court grants cert. Briefs are filed. The question presented was kind of interesting. The lawyers for Foster essentially requested that the Supreme Court grant cert on the grounds that the decision below was clearly erroneous under the extraordinary facts and circumstances. So even the cert petition didn't specifically ask for any change in the law. It simply asked the court to review a case in which the evidence of discrimination was allegedly so strong that, especially in a capital case with a death sentence, the court should take it to correct the error. The Supreme Court, perhaps surprisingly, did grant cert on that ground. And then just before arguments in the case last fall, the Supreme Court sent a notice to the attorneys for both sides that they should be prepared to discuss whether the court had jurisdiction and which of the lower court decisions was actually the proper one under review. At the oral argument, there was a fair amount of discussion about the jurisdictional question and about which of the two Georgia state court decisions was the one properly under review. The question of jurisdiction centered on whether or not there was an adequate and independent state procedural bar that justified the lower courts, the Georgia court's decisions. More specifically, was this a straight up res judicata decision, or were the merits of the federal constitutional issue intertwined with the res judicata question? The Supreme Court ultimately decided on that issue that that the two issues were intertwined, that the state habeas trial court's decision was based on a combination of the merits and the res judicata bar. In other words, the court held habeas trial court held that the res judicata bar didn't apply because there wasn't enough merit in the claim, so the merits were intertwined. Supreme Court decided that was enough to allow them to exercise jurisdiction over the case because it wasn't clear that there was an adequate and independent state law ground for the decision. The court also decided that it was, in fact, the Georgia Supreme Court's denial of the certificate of probable cause to appeal that was the subject of the cert petition. And so the court did not actually reach the ultimate decision about what to do with the case, but simply reviewed whether or not the Georgia Supreme Court should have granted leave to appeal. On the merits, the U.S. Supreme Court could not have been more clear. Chief Justice Roberts wrote the opinion. Five justices joined his opinion, so six in total on the majority opinion. Justice Alito concurred only in the judgment. Justice Thomas was the lone dissenter. Chief Justice Roberts' majority opinion was forceful and clear in expressing that the evidence that was discovered during the open records request, or as a result of the open records request, that that evidence was plenty sufficient to demonstrate that there was potential merit in the defendant's Batson claim. And I have to say, the language of this majority opinion reads a lot to me like the initial majority opinion of the Supreme Court in the first Miller L. Case back in 2003. Chief Justice Roberts did not mince words. He specifically stated on several occasions that the prosecutors who were trying to explain what they did with the peremptories at the original trial had misrepresented facts and had misrepresented the record. At one point, Chief Justice Roberts describes one of the arguments made by the state in defense of the judgment and specifically calls it nonsense. There's very little here that would give me any reason to think that the court has any second thoughts about whether or not this is a Batson claim, a valid Batson claim. At the end of the day, however, the court, Supreme Court, because it was reviewing a denial of a certificate of probable cause to appeal, the U.S. Supreme Court, in the end, remands the case to the Georgia Supreme Court for further proceedings not inconsistent with the Supreme Court's opinion. So we're back now to the Georgia Supreme Court, having been told that there should have been a certificate of probable cause issued in the case. Now the Georgia Supreme Court has to decide where to go from here. Justice Alito, writing only for himself in concurrence in the judgment, says that he agrees that the case should be remanded, that the decision of the Georgia Supreme Court to deny the certificate of probable cause, he says, cannot be affirmed. The case must be remanded. But he writes separately to explain his view about what should happen on the remand. And in particular, he expresses his view that the state courts are not precluded on remand from essentially bolstering or clarifying the scope of Georgia's res judicata rules. And according to Justice Alito, it would be plausible for the courts in Georgia on remand to make it clear that the merits have nothing to do with the res judicata holding and that the claim is barred under state res judicata law independent of the merits. That's an interesting point of view and raises all sorts of interesting questions about what would then happen next. For example, if that claim were to go forward into a federal habeas petition, we can get into that if you like during the question period. But that's just Justice Alito's view, and there's nothing at all in the majority opinion that indicates that any of the six justices in the majority agree with Justice Alito about that point. Finally, Justice Thomas, in dissent, says basically two things. First, we never should have took this case. We should have, or at a minimum, we should have asked the Georgia courts to clarify in advance whether or not there was any kind of adequate and independent state ground. So he thinks the court shouldn't have reached the merits at all. And then on the merits, he says the evidence, even the evidence that came forward at the time of the state habeas petition, was equivocal and could be read in ways that would support sustaining the judgment below. And he makes a sort of passionate argument in favor of finality, especially given that this case was originally tried about 30 years ago. Okay, that's my summary of what happened in this case. I'm more than happy to talk to anybody who has any questions at this point.
Great. Thanks, Professor Hoffman. So in a minute, we're all going to hear a prompt that's going to say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key on your phone. Okay, so while we wait for some questions to queue up, let me make a programming note. The next scheduled Teleform conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Wednesday, May 25th, at 1 o'clock p.m. It's Should the United States Cede Control of the Internet, with John Neuer and Shane Toews. And with that, we're going to go to our first audience question.
Hi, this is Roger Clegg with the Center for Equal Opportunity, and thanks very much for that very lucid and interesting presentation. I had a couple of questions. One is just if you could discuss sort of what the verdict was, and you know, whether he was given the death sentence or not, and if he was given the death sentence, then you know what happened during the, you know, what's happened during the intervening years about you know, the implementation of that sentence. And then the second thing is to take you up on your offer to expand a little bit on what Justice Alito said in his concurrence, and what's going to happen next in this case.
Right. So on the first question, he was in fact sentenced to death. So he's been on death row since the trial, you know, since the sentencing back in the late 80s. And you know, I haven't gone back and researched every single thing that's happened since the affirmance of the conviction and sentence in 1988. The Supreme Court denied U.S. Supreme Court denied cert on that initial direct appeal in 1989. The next thing we have in terms of litigation output is the state habeas petition denial in 2013. And there's nothing in the opinion that suggests what happened in the intervening years or why. My strong guess, anyone who's been, you know, done any work in the death penalty area knows that defendants who are sent to death row have no incentive to push their potential claims forward until they are facing execution. And courts in many states, you know, these are not cases that are easy to decide. They're not pleasant cases, and often these cases can sit in the courts for extended periods of time. So my assumption, since there's absolutely no record evidence of any other decisions by courts between 1989 and 2013, is that it's been sort of following the frequent path of these death penalty cases, and just been kind of lingering in a kind of low level of litigation all these years. There has been to date no federal habeas petition, so we're this guy still hasn't reached his first federal habeas petition. He was still in state court when all of this happened.
Very good. Well, that was sort of my suspicion too.
Right.
And then the second question I had was to take you up on your offer to speculate.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's so this now really gets interesting and a little bit esoteric. So for anybody who's not a kind of habeas junkie, federal habeas junkie, this might be the time to, you know, go grab a drink or something. So basically, the story here is let's assume for sake of argument that the Georgia Supreme Court on remand were to make a decision, right? They can go two ways here. They can either sort of take the message that seems apparent in the tone of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision. That message is, this was a Batson violation, fix it. That's clearly the tone of this opinion, just as it was in the Miller L litigation 10 years ago. You can't mistake it when you read the opinion. This is written in a kind of harsh tone by Roberts, who you wouldn't necessarily expect to be likely to do that, but he did here. So one possibility is the Georgia Supreme Court takes that sort of implied message and fixes it and orders a new trial, you know, orders relief. That's one possibility. The other possibility is they get the case on remand, they grant the certificate of probable cause to appeal, which the court has told them to grant, and then they deny on a clearer statement that this has nothing to do with the merits. It has to do with the fact that it's too late now, that this was decided once at the level of the, you know, the original direct appeal, and it's too late now. Res judicata bars any further litigation, no matter what evidence, no matter what new evidence someone wants to bring forward, right? That's the other way they could go. They could basically try to stonewall it and say, no, we do have an adequate and independent state procedural ground. And if they, and now that, that would seem inconsistent with some of what's come out already in the state habeas trial court and in some other things that have been said in various Georgia cases. But if they want to take that position, they are, after all, the court who can decide what state law means. And if they say, no, you know, that was loose language, we really meant to say that this claim is simply too late, case is final, it's over. Now the guy goes into federal habeas with his Batson claim. And what's going to happen there? Well, this is an unanswered and unsettled question. Typically, if a person has violated some state procedural rule, you know, as we all know, Wainwright v. Sykes, I mean, you can't avoid that same barrier in federal habeas unless either you can show actual innocence, which this guy can't, or unless you can show cause and prejudice, the classic exception to the procedural default rule. And so can this guy show cause and prejudice for his claim having been defaulted? Cause, yes, he'll win on cause because the evidence wasn't made available to him. He couldn't have gotten it at the time of his direct appeal. The open records law that he used to make this request didn't exist at that time. So basically, he's got cause for why he couldn't have presented his claim properly in 1988. But has he suffered prejudice? That's the unanswered question. Prejudice typically means that there's some reason to think that an injustice was done, that some kind of, you know, the prejudice standard in federal habeas litigation is not very well defined, but typically we think of it in terms of whether or not the case was some kind of injustice. Was that true in this case? Well, you know, no one's going to be able to show in a Batson case that there's any, you know, any particular likelihood that the result would have been different if there had been black jurors on the jury along with the white ones. And in fact, the Supreme Court's whole treatment of the Batson issue from the very beginning has been, perhaps implausibly, has proceeded on the assumption that black jurors and white jurors aren't different, and therefore why is the prosecutor striking the blacks? That's the way Batson was written. I mentioned that JEB, when it got around to gender, the court said some things a little differently there. But the original sort of thrust of Batson was that this is wrong because there's no reason to assume that black jurors, white jurors will look at a case any differently. And if that's the case, then it's kind of like, what's the harm? What's the prejudice if the jury, I mean, we know the rule is you can't strike blacks through the use of peremptories, but does it cause any harm? Does it cause any prejudice? On the other hand, Batson violations are typically, or any violations involving race discrimination in the selection of either trial or grand juries, that's typically viewed as what we call a structural error, meaning it's the kind of error where you can't defend against it by saying the error was harmless. So in a typical direct appeal case, if the defendant shows race discrimination in the selection of either the trial or the grand jury, it's an automatic rule of reversal. You don't get to argue harmless error in these cases because it's considered structural error. So now we have a kind of dilemma when it comes to cause and prejudice, do we expect defendants to be able to show prejudice from something that we haven't even acknowledged can be harmful in that sense? Or do we go with the rule that says we don't care about harm, this is a structural error? That's a question that's never been decided by the Supreme Court, and the federal circuit courts are essentially divided on that question. Although, to be fair, the more recent decisions out of several of the circuits seem to be going in the direction of saying that you don't have to show case-specific prejudice if your claim is a Batson claim, and if you get past the cause hurdle, that prejudice is kind of assumed. But that's an issue that's never been decided by the Supreme Court, and so, you know, potentially this is the kind of case that could get that issue before the Supreme Court. There really is a quite wonderful opinion by Judge Joe Flatt in the 11th Circuit a few years ago addressing this very point about the impact of Batson claims and these prejudice standards. He wrote a footnote basically explaining why this was problematic and why he felt like maybe prejudice might be something that should be presumed, although it was dictum in the case. They didn't have to go there to decide the case before them. So that's the kind of interesting habeas issue that's lurking in the background here.
That is very interesting. Thank you.
We've got about another 20 minutes with Professor Hoffman, and our lines are wide open. So, again, if you'd like to ask a question, hit star and then the pound key on your phone, and you will jump right to the front of the queue. Again, as we wait for some to...
All that habeas talk seems to have driven people away.
Yeah. Let me make one more programming note as we hopefully get a few questions. Tomorrow, 1 o'clock, is our Should the United States Cede Control of the Internet teleform about the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. Should be a good one. Again, any questions, just hit star and then the pound key on your phone. Seeing none, Professor Hoffman, why don't we we'll give you a few minutes to make some closing remarks and wrap up. But if anybody wants to jump in before we have to wrap up here, then we can still get to some questions. So,
no problem. To sum up, I think, you know, the takeaway message: Foster v. Chapman makes no new law. I mean, it's that simple. This is a case that was very fact specific, very much hooked to the fact that this was a death penalty case in which there was a, you might say, smoking gun of material in prosecutor files that, you know, to be quite frank, you're not going to find stronger evidence of a Batson claim than was introduced in the state habeas case in this situation. The presence of a smoking gun, the presence of all that information in the prosecutor's files indicating that they were very, very consciously acting on the basis of race, it makes this a really exceptional case. And that's how the cert petition was framed. And that's really what the case is about. It's about the Supreme Court dealing with a very specific factual circumstance. And so it's not that surprising. Anyone who reads the case would probably recognize pretty quickly that there's no new law being made here. The Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, really wanted to just send a signal that you can't ignore this kind of evidence and you got to deal with it. Now it's up to the Georgia Supreme Court to decide how they want to deal with it. The case could get interesting in a legal sense if the Georgia Supreme Court declines to act on the merits and the case then moves forward into federal habeas, then it's going to present a very interesting legal issue about the nature of prejudice in this kind of Batson case. But on the face of it, I would say Foster v. Chapman is mostly about the Supreme Court sending a signal to lower courts, like they did in the Miller L case about 10 years ago, sending a signal to lower courts to be vigilant and not to ignore especially this kind of clear evidence of racial discrimination. And at that point, I think we'll just have to wait and see what happens when the case gets back to the Georgia courts.
All right. One last call for questions. Hit star and then the pound key on your telephone. All right. Seeing none, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Professor Hoffman for joining us on today's call, and thanks also to our audience. And remember to call in tomorrow at 1 o'clock for our teleforum, Should the United States Cede Control of the Internet? Until then, we're adjourned. Thanks, Professor Hoffman.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.